What's a white hat hacker?
A white hat hacker is a hacker for good. So that can mean a variety of things, but in this case, the kind of core activity a white hat hacker does in breaking and entering is she is a hacker that individuals and institutions hire to try to break into them to see how they can be broken into. So she's trying to break into them before the bad guys do so they can patch their holes.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Jeremy Smith about his nonfiction thriller, Breaking and Entering, the extraordinary story of a hacker called Alien. Don't go away. And the press for the book includes this statement: hackers know everything about us, but we know almost nothing about them until now. So why write the biography of a female hacker called Alien?
Well, I think, you know, there's that opportunity. We all are aware that we're being hacked, our economy, our culture, our politics. And we know these hacks are targeting us individually and that they're targeting the institutions we rely on. But we don't have a face to a hacker. If you say, what does a hacker look like? People either don't know or they go back to sort of the stereotypes that are 30, 40 years old. You're looking at Matthew Broderick in War Games or Angelina Jolie in Hackers. And so that face of the industry has grown up and professionalized and changed. So when I met a hacker at a play date for my preschool daughter, I knew something had changed in hacking and I wanted to be able to share that story.
Right. So you mentioned the encounter and I'm just wondering if you can describe it in a little more detail. It sounds like a really odd encounter that led to this book.
Well, it started like a very normal encounter.
Okay.
And I think that's, you know, I call the preface The Hacker Next Door. And it's because where are these hackers? We think of faceless figures in hoodies in basements on the dark web or teenagers or foreign agents. But in this case, I went to pick my daughter up from preschool. She was playing with another little girl. And the mom and I started chatting. And the mom said, what do you do? I said, I'm a writer. I described some of my writing. I said, what do you do? She said, well, tomorrow I have to break into a bank. And I realized I should stop speaking about myself and I should ask follow-up questions. And that's kind of what I did for the next year or two.
One of the things that fascinated me about the book was you referenced the culture of MIT, and I know you went to Harvard. And one of the bits about MIT you write is work, sleep, friends, choose two. So that's the MIT culture. How would you describe the culture at Harvard when you were there?
Well, you know, the joke was always MIT is the party school nearby. So you could imagine, you know, for me, I had a great time at Harvard. I read a lot. I made good friends. I drew a daily comic strip. I pretty much nerded out, and there were a lot of other people nerding out. I didn't go to very many parties. The study spaces were always, you know, overpacked with other people studying. But I like to find my own niche, and I like to talk to people who were smart about things I wasn't, which became my writing niche. At the same time, I guess there were lots of other cultures at Harvard. You know, when I saw the movie The Social Network, it was unrecognizable to me, the entire sort of finals club scene. I knew there were these clubs, but it was not talked about or coveted by anyone I hang out with. So I don't know if that's the movie version or if there was just a movie version happening right next to me and I was in the sort of study and be a nerd version, which was the right version for me.
So I'm imagining as part of doing the research for this book that you maybe went to MIT and did some poking around. What was it like to go back then?
Well, you know, there's another joke about MIT and Harvard. They're right next to each other, and they're both obviously, you know, top schools in their own way. And they say when you take the college tour at Harvard, they tell you who slept in, you know, what famous person slept in this building, George Washington, Nelson Mandela, whoever. And at MIT, they tell you what famous architect built the building. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a difference. That's a building, hands-on culture. Right. And, you know, to me, that was the MIT experience that I got to experience as a researcher. And so I went back maybe 2-3 times to Cambridge and focus on MIT. And that was pretty much a new world to me. I'd had a friend or two at MIT, so I'd been there. But the idea of hacking in the sense that they do it there, which means exploring physical spaces, rooftops, elevator shafts, ledges, steam tunnels, that was all new to me. And that was exciting. And that was somewhat terrifying. And getting to do that was a thrill. And I think that gave me that hook into that culture that I wouldn't have gotten just by hearing about it secondhand. Mm.
That's right. I think that's an important distinction to make for listeners is the book begins with very physical hacking that then transforms into more computer-based, you know, web-based hacking.
Yeah, I mean, I was proud that I think the first 100 pages of a book about hackers, I don't think has a computer except for, you know, maybe one or two scenes.
Right.
And that's because there is this history and tradition of hacking that's over 100 years old, that predates computers, where it is, as I said, exploring these physical spaces. And sometimes that has outward signs the public can see when the hackers pull an elaborate, ingenious prank, like getting a police car on top of the Great Dome at MIT, or, you know, turning the tallest building on campus into a playable Tetris game, or getting a living room lounge set complete with, I think, maybe a billiards table and a cat in a easy chair upside down on the arch outside the media lab. But much more often, it's just exploring for exploration's sake and trying to find these hidden, unknown spaces that members of the public and maybe even the designers of the building themselves didn't know about. And in that hacking culture, the, you know, ethos is you leave your little mark, a little kind of graffiti-like symbol called a sign-in. But in there, you would never leave a sign-in where a normal person in the public could see. It's something only other hackers could see. So it's not showing off. It's sort of passing on the word within your very insular community.
I can't wait to talk more about the ethos and rules of hacking, but will you just start by getting us into the mind of a hacker? Like, who is a hacker and what's their motivation?
Well, you know, I talked to somebody at one of the hacker conferences in Las Vegas, one of the biggest in the world. And he sort of traced the progression of hacking in four words: fun, fame, profit, power. And I think, you know, for most of hacking's history, including computer hacking, it was for fun. Mm-hmm. It's having these systems that you can explore and get inside and take control of, not to hurt other people or make money, but to kind of understand them better than even their designers themselves. And then there's an element of fame, showing off to other people, kind of getting your cred built up, but that's still very much within that community. Mm-hmm. You know, I compare it to like a skateboarding like subculture until the late 90s. And what happens is we move more and more of our society and the systems we rely on and our basic functions on a daily basis onto computers and onto network computers and onto the internet. So in a weird way, you could say we've invaded hacker space rather than hackers invading our space. They were always playing on computers and computer networks, mm-hmm. but we've pushed our society there. And that meant hacking professionalized, and it mm-hmm. became something people could do for a living for the first time. And that's, you know, that sort of birth of the information security industry is kind of the path Alien takes in Breaking and Entering. And we know that when government bodies do this, it's a power grab. Our government might hack Iran. Israel might hack Saudi Arabia. Russia might hack all of us, and mm-hmm. so on and so forth. So it can be very powerful indeed if you control these systems on which people rely.
And one of Alien's first hacks is the F script. Can you describe that?
Yeah, I love it because it's such a human motivation. This is a time before cell phones. This is a time, you know, before social networks. And she just wants to find her friends, mm-hmm. to hang out with them in between the massive stress of working and doing problem sets at MIT. So she wants a way to find all of her friends really quickly. Mm-hmm. So she uses this command called finger, which is a Unix command that if you type a username in, it will tell you when they were last logged in on a particular machine. And she sets up this massive automated script to finger all of her friends and then kind of reverse engineer by the machine names that get returned where they are on campus. So she's tracking sort of anyone she wants to at MIT in real time. So she can just say, oh, I want to only know who's within 5 minutes of me, who's within 10 minutes of me, who's next door, or where's this guy I've got a crush on.
Right.
So, you know, she can find people almost by magic, and that's a form of hacking too.
Some of the rules of hackers are never drink and hack, never hack alone, know your limitations and don't exceed them, and if you get caught, accept gracefully and cooperate fully. What's your sense, being in the hacking community, about the rules, ethics, integrity? You know, how closely do they hew to those kinds of morals?
Right. Are they observed? Are they observed?
Yeah.
Are they honored in the breach? You know, those are made at MIT, and those refer to the physical hacking world there. And there's a mural on campus in a kind of hidden space that only other hackers could find that lists these kind of like 10 commandments. Not all of those in that exact order, but a lot of those. And I think there is this risk-taking, this is experimentation, and it's encouraged. But along with it is also responsibility. And the idea is you're taking these risks, and there's going to be rewards and there's going to be consequences sometimes. So, you know, don't drink and hack means, you know, don't be a jerk. You're taking these risks and you're going into these physically perilous spaces. Don't do it in a way that you could hurt yourself. You could hurt it someone else. I mean, there's a scene in Breaking and Entering when aliens climbing up an elevator shaft. If you do that in anything short of ultimate sobriety,
right,
and you fall, you're not only going to hurt yourself, you're going to hurt all the people underneath you. And I think having that culture and that community is key to ethical hacking. And that's not always seen on the internet or in sort of far-flung hacker communities. And so I also think it hurts hackers and hacking it themselves to not have a face to hackers, to not have a community. When people know each other, when they can have cultural norms, when they can reward each other for good behavior as well as cool exploits, I think that leads to better behavior and more creative expression. So I think hacker conventions, which was another topic totally new to me, is a sort of extension of that kind of MIT community, but on a national, international level.
So it's interesting. In the press materials for the book, one of the notes that you make is, if we really want to keep ourselves and our society safe, we should give white hat hackers, the good guys, a truly public role and public platform. So is that what you mean by what you just said, is to sort of honor them or recognize them as human beings? And
yeah, I mean, I think about the history of medicine. Okay, surgeons used to be considered body snatchers, and they were accused of taking corpses or even killing people to get them a corpse sooner and experimenting on them. And those accusations were sometimes true.
Mm-hmm.
But without surgeons, we wouldn't have advances in medicine and health. And I think that's true of hackers and hacking too. They're taking apart our systems, sometimes for ill, sometimes to explore, sometimes to exploit. And I think if we give them a more public role, we listen to the good guys, we, you know, try to give them sort of respect, and we try to find faces and people that, and, you know, bodies, companies that we can, you know, trust, then we'll all be better served.
So there's this really interesting moment in the book where Alien breaks into a bank and has to manipulate through a manager, and in 5 minutes is standing in the vault, basically. And once the manager realizes she's been hacked, she says to Alien, you know, I will hate you forever. And I just want to understand, what are the social repercussions of being a hacker then?
Yeah, it's tricky. You know, I talked to, you know, Alien now leads a company that of, you know, white hat hackers, and not everyone takes to lying for a living if they have to do it face to face. On the other hand, some people take to it very readily, and that can be alarming too. And it's a tricky job too, because even when you succeed, you can't tell other people about it, you know, because you're there to serve the client. So you can't just tell everyone, I wouldn't go to that bank because I just broke into it in 5 minutes. You have to help the bank fix itself. So there are those sort of professional guidelines. But as for, you know, how do you manipulate people and feel good about
it?
You know, her response is better me than the bad guys, one. And two, you know, think of a doctor, you know, the analogy she uses when training someone else that she's tricked and she feels bad about it is, she says, you know, it's kind of like a doctor tapping on your knee to test your reflexes. You know, we've got to test your reflexes or everyone's going to be more vulnerable. So I think she's made that kind of peace with it. And She also has a risk-taking personality, a pretty confident personality. She's not afraid to fail. So I think, you know, that lets her go past boundaries that a lot of us would halt at.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with Jeremy Smith about breaking and entering, the extraordinary story of a hacker called Alien. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. In terms of the craft of writing the book, how did you go back and recreate the minutiae and the dialogue?
Sure. So I wanted it to be sort of a nonfiction novel. I wanted it to be really from her point of view. And that required a huge level of access from her, a huge level of revision from me, because I would get it wrong over and over. Even if I got the facts right, she would say, "You got the feelings wrong." Mm. And I did sort of the normal foot leather of reporting. I went to all the sites in the book and took meticulous notes. I interviewed everyone I could who had been in, you know, most of the characters who are alive. By the end of the book, I talked to if I could. I went to most of the sites, whether that's MIT, whether that's Los Alamos National Laboratory, whether that's the hacker convention scene in Vegas. And I also, you know, did the kind of things where you look up the weather on a particular day in a particular place. Mm-hmm. But she also has pretty copious records. You know, she is a more technical version, you could say, or part of her job is she's a forensics specialist, right? She's a data hoarder in part. And so when I got things wrong over and over, ultimately that was a strain because she got really frustrated. I got frustrated, but she gave me a whole bunch of sort of diaries, journals, documents that let me recreate things in a much greater level of intimacy that I normally would have been able to.
What was your working process like with her?
I think it was close and closer. It was about mutual trust, you know, to someone who is as private and in as secretive a business as she is, with as many ups and downs and, you know, personal twists and turns as she has and had in her story. I think it required a lot of trust of her, you know, of me to tell that story and get it right. And at the same time, I couldn't have done it without the access she provided. So I had to trust that she'd stick with me, even though as a writer, I knew this was going to be wrong, and then it was going to be bad, and then it was going to be okay. It was going to be a long path to kind of good, the normal revision process.
Right.
And it either would have blown up or we would have become, you know, pretty good friends, and luckily we became pretty good friends.
And within the first 20 pages, you make note of the gender stereotypes. You know, you pull in this scene from MIT with guys joking around that if the admission rates were really based on IQ distribution, that there should be 15% females or something. Why was it important for you to establish that as a theme?
Well, one, it was her lived experience. So, you know, she didn't decry sexism at every turn, but she faced it at many crucial points. And those are just part of what I wanted to depict. So it's hard to know what do I need to underline and what do I need to mention but kind of pass over quickly. And, you know, I think key things like how do you join a boys club, which is what the hacker communities are over and over and over again, at least until she's able to form her own company, I think that's important. And whether you're an outsider of any kind, you know, your differences can be a strength, she discovers, but for a long time, they're going to be kind of held against you, and you're not going to get the same default assumption of competence or skill that a guy in this case would get.
Would you read us a passage about this?
Love to. So this is after her undergraduate time at MIT and after a time at Los Alamos National Laboratory, the birthplace of the atomic bomb, where in both those cases, she gets into network forensics and then into coding itself after her physical exploration hacking has kind of ended in the middle of her undergraduate time at MIT. Alien returned to Cambridge in September 2003 and rejoined the MIT network security team. After Jake's tutelage at Los Alamos and months of work on her project there, she could match Unix skills and computer programming chops with anyone. Working in MIT's IT department was no longer a temporary gig, a way to cover expenses and complete an interesting research project en route to graduation. Alien now had the authority and responsibility to safeguard one of the world's foremost computing environments. When she arrived, the Institute was still dealing with the fallout of Blaster and related worms that took advantage of similar vulnerabilities. The expense of cleaning up affected machines and recovering data ran about $1 million, not counting the collateral costs of computer downtime during the crisis and the irrecoverable loss of many files. As soon as possible, Alien rewrote NetVision so that she had more visibility. Then she reviewed what had happened and began formulating a strategic plan for how the network security team should respond to large-scale emergencies in the future. As this planning was taking place, new leaders with their own ideas took over information services. They merged it with other organizational units at MIT, renamed the new entity Information Systems and Technology, and installed a corporate culture, including a 9-to-5 workday and dress code. A rumor spread that soon employees would have to wear branded baseball caps like fast food workers. Several of the colleagues Alien respected most, people who had worked there for decades, specifically because they wanted to be at MIT instead of a place like IBM, were pushed out or quit. Marie left in 2004. Alien stayed on for several more months until a meeting with her new boss. Success going forward would be measured by counting the number of closed case tracker cases, he said. That's not a real security improvement, Alien objected. Most of our open cases come from automated warnings. They might be nothing. A better metric would be the number of active cases, and then what's a priority among them. The man's face turned red. If you keep interrupting people, one day somebody's going to slap you, he said. Alien felt personally threatened, and by the man she was supposed to go to for help if she was harassed. She was sure he would never have said that to someone older than her or to a male employee of any age. She quit.
How would you describe some of the other obstacles she faced as a woman?
There's a job interview scene, and it's actually a dinner with a couple guys she wants to consider her for a job, and they don't consider it a job interview, but she does. And the commentary there, I think, speaks of her experiences before and after, which is that if you are a guy, the default assumption is that you know what you're talking about. And if you're a woman, the default assumption in this technical field is you don't. And so she works very hard in that conversation to be both charming and, you know, lively and sociable, but also to weave in a bunch of very technical references to show her technical chops, including stories of some of the exploits she's already pulled. And I think that's true. You know, similar things like that happen her freshman year when she's exploring buildings. Sometimes when she's on the network security teams, she has a pretty supportive boss when she's at the hospital and Los Alamos. So those are positive experiences. But, you know, when she's going to security conferences, and this is true of, you know, most women in security until pretty recently, if not still today, you know, the default question is, who are you with rather than what do you do? Mm-hmm. The assumption is you're someone's date rather than, you know, an established hacker in your own right.
Speaking of dating, Jeremy, one of the things that surprised me in the book was the attention to her love life. And I caught myself wondering, you know, if Alien was a man, would we care who was in her bed? And so I wanted to know, how did you work on that element of her character? Was that a plot device? Was it with consent? Was it with her initiation even to talk about her boyfriends?
Yeah, I mean, we often, you know, my joke with her is that, you know, her boyfriends could be sort of their own superhero team, her ex-boyfriends. They're all sort of amazing people with extraordinary skills. And they're usually a mix of kind of artist and engineer. So you have roboticists, you have lockpickers, you have artists and muralists, you have poets, you know, you have arborists, you have, you know, all sorts of people with different skills. And I think for her, they were important to her hacker's education in the sense that they all exposed her to a different world. And, you know, I wanted to depict what was important to her at the time. So in college, sometimes, you know, she described herself as boy crazy at times. And so she wrote some of those scripts to literally find boys she had a crush on. And that's part of the motivation. Or, you know, people she would work with in group projects. And later, that is also a segue or an entryway to certain of the new worlds that she's trying to break into, is sometimes it's through a guy she's seeing.
In terms of your relationship with hacking, have you ever been hacked?
I'm sure if hacked means manipulated in a way that's beyond my control, right? We're all hacked. We're all advertised to. We all get emails that if we click on them, they'll lead us to losing our data or something like that, or threatening the data of other people and infecting our friends and family, or getting phone calls that are from people that are not who they say they are. Mm-hmm. And so I can't say I've had a big aha victim moment, but I have, in the course of researching and reporting the book, come to a much greater wariness of both my own practices and those of the institutions I rely on, which is in some ways even scarier. You know, if I screw up, okay, hopefully I've taken some safeguards to, you know, be able to recover. But what if my airline does, or my bank, or my hospital? Those are places that are, you know, hold my life in their hands often, but are often beyond my control.
There was this really powerful piece in the back of the book when Alien tells you that by 2020, there are going to be an estimated 30 billion connected devices with really no security management ready to do a hacker's bidding. For instance, self-driving cars and even fitness tracking devices. This is overwhelming to me. So what's your advice then for the commoner?
Well, I mean, we're all commoners in some sense, right? We all rely on this technology, and the technology is often a boon. It makes our lives, you know, it opens new opportunities in our lives. And I think that be a savvy consumer. If you get something that says it's a smart watch, a smart refrigerator, a smart thermostat, a smart mirror, a smart doll, realize that smart just means could be hacked. And ask questions about the security. If it is a low-cost consumer item, then be more suspicious about the security. Self-driving cars are going to get much more press about being hacked, but there's also going to be substantial security investments made by companies like Tesla. Now, a $40 security camera or doorbell or you get off Amazon, that might just be something where there's very little security behind it. But that could lead to your own house being kind of held for ransom by a hacker. A hacker can turn up or down your heat or turn it off or control your oven or spy through your camera. So, you know, you want to be aware, what are the systems you're installing and what is the security on those systems? And if you don't know, then maybe don't be so smart until you have better assurances.
Jeremy Smith has written for The Atlantic, Discover, and The New York Times. He lives with his wife and daughter in Missoula, Montana. Look for more information about his work at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and visit our Facebook page. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.